Welcome to Now Appalachia. The Appalachian region covers 13 states in the U.S., and over 25 million people call the region home. This podcast profiles the authors and publishers with connections to Appalachia and how the region influences and impacts their creative work. And now, here's your host, author and Appalachian resident, Elliot Parker.
And hello once again, friends. We welcome you back to another episode of Now Appalachia. We are broadcast and heard across the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Great to have you with us for another episode. I'm your host, Elliot Parker, and we are going to be talking to author Kevin Dunn about his brand new book. It's called Vicious Is My Middle Name. It has one of the coolest titles I can think of any book that we have talked about and profiled on the program, and the content matches the title for sure. And so I'm so glad to have Kevin with us today. He joins us. He is a member of several bands. He runs a small record label, publishes zines, and also writes for Razor Cake magazine. He also works at a small liberal arts college called Hobart and Williams Smith Colleges, where he teaches and publishes on a range of topics consisting from African politics to international relations to global punk. And he and his family split their time between Western New York State and Western North Carolina. And the book that we're going to be talking about today, Vicious Is My Middle Name, is his first novel. So, Kelvin, hello to you. Welcome to the program. So glad to have you with us today.
Thank you. It's really nice to be here, Ellie. I appreciate it. I'm a big fan of the podcast, so it's great to be here.
Thank you so much. I appreciate you tuning in and listening to the show, for sure. But I wanted to ask you about your protagonist, because I feel like we could spend a whole time, or our time together, or a whole episode talking about her. But she's just a fantastic character. But her name is Sydney Vicious Talcott. And I was reading some reviews about your book, and one of the words that kept coming up to describe her was quote-unquote punk. A lot of the reviewers said that she is quote-unquote punk. What does that mean exactly, and how does that apply to her as a character?
Yeah, well, I'll start by saying that Sydney exists because my youngest child is named Strummer Dunn, named after Joe Strummer. And Strummer, when I started writing this novel, Strummer is a voracious reader. She was 12 when I started writing this. And I realized that of all the books she's reading, she didn't see herself in these books, right? She, whether it was Harry Potter or whatever she was reading, she always kind of didn't see herself. So when I set out to write this book, I really intended that Sydney Talcott was a kind of a protagonist that my own child, Strummer, could see themselves in. And Strummer is a very unique, wonderful individual, my Strummer. And so she identifies herself as a little punk in the sense that she listens to a lot of punk music, but more than that is she kind of embraces an ethos of punk, of kind of doing things for herself, of kind of organizing her friends, instead of waiting for someone to solve a problem they might have, she's very much going to roll up her sleeves, work with people and try and solve that herself, right? And so, you know, I've done work on, I mean, she picks this up because she's surrounded by, among other things, my own interest in punk and punk culture. And so I think she's incorporates that, excuse me, ethos of punk and punk culture. And then that is manifested 100% in Sydney Talcott.
And she's got some of those elements of punk that you're talking about, that cultural motifs associated with punk. She's got dyed hair. She wears Doc Martens. Sydney does. She sports a lot of band t-shirts. So I think when people think of that word punk and kind of some of the stereotypes associated with that, you know, we see Sydney kind of displaying that.
Yeah, she definitely embraces that identity.
I wanted to ask you a little bit, too, about place in your story, because it's really, really important in what happens here. And we find that Sydney and her family have been spending a lot of time, and she's really grown up in Rochester, New York. But then she moves from there and is brought to Beaver Dam, North Carolina. So what kind of life is she leaving in Rochester, New York, and what kind of a culture and a life is she walking into in Beaver Dam, North Carolina?
Yeah, I mean, she's definitely an urban kid in New York State when she leaves Rochester. And she leaves Rochester because her mother relocates her down to her own parents' house. So Sydney's grandparents' place there in Beaver Dam, North Carolina. And Beaver Dam's a made-up location, but it definitely has a very specific, you know, location for me, which is there in Western North Carolina, outside of Boone. And she finds herself in not just a rural setting, which she's not used to, but a mountain setting there in the Appalachians. And at first she just doesn't connect and doesn't understand why things are different, why things are, you know, the way they are in a rural or a mountain setting. And then she, I think, really learns to appreciate and love and value her surroundings. I mean, I'm glad that was your second question, right? I'm glad you picked up on that, because when I was writing it, I really wanted to make her surroundings, Appalachia, another character in the book, right? That she has a relationship with that gets closer and closer. And that, I mean, it's, by the end, she's deeply in love with where she's found herself.
When we see her kind of functioning inside of the school setting, she feels like she is very much an outcast, and she kind of runs to the school library and tries to hide. And I think there's so many of us listening to the podcast that remember those days when we were in middle school or junior high and high school and trying to find our fit and find our click and find our niche. But she really struggles with that. And then she comes across two students who she identifies with and really makes a connection with. One of those is a Guatemalan American named Rita. The other is an Appalachian character named Sean. And what she kind of finds is that both of them have been kind of treated or labeled outcasts, or they feel like outcasts. So what is it about them that has made them an outcast, Sean and Rita? And then what kind of reception does Sydney get when she meets them for the first time?
Yeah, that's great, right? So Sean and Rita, you know, represents a kind of diversity within Appalachian demographics, right, that make up modern Appalachia, but are not fully embraced in the school, right? So you've got Guatemalan immigrant family, and then Sean, who's an Appalachian, a young Black man, who's been in the region for generations and generations, but whether it's the color of their skin, the kind of ethnic, and in some cases, as the book kind of picks up, a kind of class background, they're outcasts, they're misfits. They've kind of found themselves on the margins of the school social pecking order, but they're okay with that. They've made their, you know, they've come to terms with that, and they found their place in the library. I don't know if that was where you found your place in middle school. It definitely was where I found my place.
Me too.
Yeah, I think there's a lot of us out there. And so what's interesting is that initially, Rita's very warm and embracing of Sydney, where I think Sean kind of feels that threat of here's a tough, rough and tumble urban kid coming into his space. So there's a little hesitancy there, but they overcome that fairly quickly. And they kind of unite together as this kind of band of not just misfits, but also book nerds. I mean, they're bonding over reading. I had a lot of fun kind of thinking about what books they might be reading and connecting with.
And I love their strongest connection is centered on, in terms of books and reading, is on Harry Potter. And yeah. I was thinking about, you know, I've only read a couple of the Harry Potter books, but I was thinking about those three characters, about Sydney, Rita, and Sean. And I feel like what you've constructed with them are characteristics. I could see them existing in a Harry Potter type story, but I also could see some of the Harry Potter characters' temperaments and attitudes and things, philosophies reflected in them. So I love that you made it around Harry Potter.
Oh, great. Thank you. I appreciate that.
I wanted to ask you too, and this kind of takes us into another part of the story, sort of another major plot line, is that Sydney learns that there in Beaver Dam, there is going to be an asphalt plant that is going to be built near the school. And there's this whole situation where you've got sort of a rich landowner in town there in Beaver Dam, and sort of this corrupt company that's coming in and wanting to build this asphalt plant. And we get a sense that It's all about money and profit for them. They're not as concerned about, you know, the environmental or land consequences that are to come from that. What is it about Sydney that gets her so interested in that? Being from a big city and kind of trying to get herself acclimated to rural Appalachia and here in Beaver Dam, what gets her so fascinated and interested in this asphalt plant, and what kind of makes her decide, okay, we've got to stand up and say, no, this isn't right. No, we're not going to stand for just letting this company come in and build this this plant next to our school, which has is going to cause some health complications for us.
Yeah, right. I think for Sydney, it's that kind of realization that she's falling in love with Appalachia, right? She's falling in love with the environment. She's really starting to appreciate where she finds herself, and then suddenly she sees it under threat. And she sees it under threat from, you know, external forces, kind of this kind of evil corporation, but also kind of internal forces of these kind of, let's call them a corrupt, powerful family within the area, who are not putting the citizens and the environment's interest up front. And so I think what she's realizing is that, you know, she's at a place where she's really falling in love and she's seeing this threat. And initially she tries to think about some of the ways that she can rally some support and challenge it, write a letter to the editor or what have you. And then she realizes, for kind of developments within the novel, that she needs to use the skills that she's acquired as a little punk, right? A do-it-yourself punk. Let's make some zines, let's start organizing ourselves, make some posters, make some t-shirts, print them ourselves, start organizing ourselves and see what we can do to stand up to these forces. And there's that element within punk, but I think you see this with Sydney, is self-empowerment, right? You know, that instead of waiting for someone to come rescue her and her friends, they're gonna do it themselves. And they had that sense of empowerment that I think emerges across the story. I hope so, at least.
You know, and I love that you said that, because I felt like when we got to that section of the book, I felt like that Rita and Sean had educated in some ways Sydney a little bit about being different racially and being different ethnically. But then she's kind of educating them through, like you were saying, the protesting and the creating the zines and ultimately music. She kind of leans on music as a way to kind of rally the community. So there's kind of dual education going on. You know, they're kind of educating Sydney. Sean and Rita are on some areas where she's not very familiar, but then she's educating them on some ways that you can speak up and use different methods to get attention. I just love that each of them were kind of, whether they realized or not, were teaching each other something. And I was wondering, was that something you set out to do with those characters, or did that just kind of happen as the plot was unfolding?
That's a great question, Elliot, right? So I definitely set out that Sydney was going to be sharing some of the philosophy behind DIY punk. I've got an academic book, a nonfiction book on global punk. And there's these elements there in terms of how punk helps empower people and helps build communities and so forth. So, you know, with Sydney, she's kind of talking about some of those elements about punk that I wanted her to share. And in those conversations, you kind of surprise yourself when you're writing. When Sean and Rita start pushing back on her, and there's a passage where Sean points out her own privilege and saying, look, we're outcast because of our color of our skin or our class. That's why we're marginalized. You're an outcast because you choose to be an outcast, right? You choose to wear the clothes that you're wearing. You choose to look the way you do, and that's feeding your kind of misfit outcast position. And I hadn't actually intended, that wasn't part of the conversation. I quickly realized that to be true to my characters, that's what they would have to say back to Sydney. And it was one of those, for me as a writer, beautiful moments of saying, oh, I can see how this is going to play itself out. I can see how these characters would talk to each other. This makes perfect sense, and this is an important message that Sydney needs to hear.
We're speaking with author and professor Kevin Dunn here on this episode of Now Appalachia. We're talking to him about his first novel. It's called Vicious Is My Middle Name, one of the coolest titles we've ever talked about and had on the program. And Kevin, we'll come back to the book in just a second. I wanted to ask you something along the lines of young adult books and young adult readers. I noticed on the back of the book, it had an age range recommended from 9 to 12. And so I just did a little research and I found a Washington Post article from 2017 or 2018 that said a majority of young adult books that are purchased, or at least it purchased at that time that that story was written, are by adults, not necessarily the teenagers and the, you know, the upper elementary school, the early middle school, maybe even late middle school, early high school students that you think would read this. And I was thinking about your book and I thought, you know, I could see this being the type of book that parents and kids could read together. You know, the mom and dad could read it while the child was reading it too. I just wondered your thoughts on that, about writing in this genre for that age group, and how it seems that some of the things that you cover in this book, you know, about race and differences and, you know, reestablishing what home means and finding the value in that, are so universal, not just for kids of that age group, but also for adults. And your thoughts on that, and why so many of us adults are reading young adult literature these days. And yeah.
That's interesting, you know, because I actually read a lot of these types of books, right, age 9 to 12 or age 9 to 18, because my kids are constantly telling me, oh, Dad, you have to read this book, or you have to read this book. And we'll read them together. I mean, they don't share everything with me, and I don't share everything that I read with them, but we do share the same kind of interest in genres, especially around middle grade, young adult. And I think it's great that for myself, I'm having these conversations with my kids around something outside. You know, it's not a TV show that we watch together, but it's a book. And so we can get much more, go deep into the conversations about what the book's doing, how the authors are addressing these issues, and what are some of those complicated issues at play there. And I think it's great. And so when I set out to write this book, I very much wanted to make sure it was for my kids, but I also was trying to write a book that I would enjoy and that other, you know, parents of kids would enjoy as well.
So you have kids kind of in that middle school age range. And I wanted to ask you, you know, of course, this isn't a scientific question with polling and data, but do you feel like that age group, because I know you have children and they have friends and you kind of are around that age group a lot, do you feel like they are reading? They are enjoying reading? You know, we hear so much about, well, this is the iPad, you know, social media generation. But I'm always amazed when I go to bookstores in my community and different communities, there are a lot of kids in there buying books, and there are a lot of parents in there buying books for their kids. And again, I know this isn't sort of scientific with data and all of that and metrics used, but do you get a sense that kids are still reading, kids in that age range are still reading? And is it just a matter of them finding books that work for them?
Absolutely, Elliot. I do. And I know, you know, anecdotally, it's my kids and my kids' friends and their friends. But those are a lot of kids. And they talk about books all the time. They share books. Both of my kids are voracious readers. And their friend groups, which is quite large, are voracious readers as well. I mean, I know that's not, again, as you pointed out, it's not scientific. But I feel good about this generation and how literate they are and how discerning they are as well. And you know, you mentioned Harry Potter. I think both my kids, Harry Potter was a huge hook for them, that they really got into Harry Potter and then they just kept going. My eldest got into Agatha Christie and they just kept going in terms of now their interest in mysteries and so forth. You know, again, it's not scientific, but I'm always heartened when I'm walking through bookstores, and my kids are in the bookstore, but they're not the only kids in the bookstore, right? There's often a whole bunch of kids pulling books off the shelves and figuring out how many they're going to be able to buy for their allowance that week.
I feel the same way, and it heartens me in a good way to see that, because you know we hear so much about kids aren't reading, and I just want to do this and that and play on the iPad and the phone and the computer. But then when you actually see it in person, it's really a great thing to see. So I want to ask you one more question, then we'll get back to the book. If we were to sneak into your office or sneak into your bedroom and take a peek on the nightstand, what books might we see in your currently reading or to be read pile?
There's a very large pile there, right? Very large pile. You know, I recently started reading a lot of noir and mysteries again. S.A. Cosby, who's a writer just off the foothills there in Virginia, is just making some amazing art with his books. I'm a big Colson Whitehead fan. Sarah Grand, who is a really interesting murder mystery, has a Claire DeWitt series. Emily St. John, what's her last name? Mindell. She wrote Station 11, but she also wrote The Glass Hotel. Is a big favorite of mine. Those are, and then you'll also find next to those books a whole bunch of memoirs from musicians or nonfiction books about music as well.
Very good. Kevin Dunn joins us on this episode of Now Appalachia. We're talking to him about his new book, Vicious Is My Middle Name, and also about writing and young adult literature and children and reading patterns. And so I wanted to go back to the book for just a couple minutes as we have some time here remaining, Kevin, to talk a little bit about this. I wanted to ask you, I know you touched on this earlier. We were talking about the education that kind of exists between Rita and Sean and Sydney, and then kind of what Sydney educates them about, you know, sort of her experiences growing up in a different part of the country and in sort of the big city. You know, one of the things I loved is that she learns a lot. I feel like by the time we get to the end of the story, Sydney learns a lot about Appalachian culture. And you mentioned that she kind of ends up realizing that this is going to be an okay place. What were some of the things about Appalachian culture you feel like that she takes away from her experience? Not only the experience of sort of protesting the asphalt plant getting built next to the school, but just her kind of experiences being in the school and meeting Sean and Rita. What do you think are her big takeaways about Appalachian culture?
Yeah, you know, I don't think it ever becomes explicit, but one of the implicit things is that some of her assumptions about what Appalachia is become challenged, right? And that was something I was trying to do in the book, right? Is to really show contemporary Appalachia is a very diverse place in terms of demographics, in terms of the issues. You know, those of us who kind of identify as Appalachian residents, you know, I moved in 1989 to Western North Carolina. I've lived there on and off ever since. And it's always, you know, it was a realization for myself to kind of recognize the diversity and the richness of Appalachia. And I wanted to kind of embed that in the story for Sydney as well, to realize that, oh, you know, there's that, you know, it never gets mentioned, but there's a hillbilly kind of trope that never, you know, doesn't exist, and doesn't exist in this book at all, right? She's encountering a whole diverse set of people that make up Appalachia. And I think that's really important for Sydney to come to realize and to appreciate.
Do you feel like there could be another book in the works for Sydney Talcott? Could we see her in another adventure? Could we see Sean and Rita make another appearance? Or did you really want this to be just sort of a standalone story?
As soon as I always intended to be a standalone story. And as soon as I finished it and sent it off, the brain starts working and going, well, I think I know what's going to happen the next year. Now, I have been working on a couple of other projects that don't involve any of these characters. But I do in my notebook have it sketched out a possible second and a possible third book that would fit together. But you know, who knows? We'll see what happens.
I understand. Very good. And one question I want to ask you as we finish up, your process for writing. I know you do a lot of different things. You're writing some writing for magazines. You're a writer for Razor Cake magazine. You write for them. You publish zines. You know, you're teaching certainly at Hobart and William Smith colleges. So How do you write? How do you find time to write? Do you write every day, or are you just sort of a sporadic writer? How does all that work for you? How did you, what was your writing process like for this book in particular?
Well, this book in particular, I was really lucky because I was off of teaching and I found myself in Ireland for 3 months. And I would get up every morning and I would get my kids their breakfast and then get their lunch and get them out the door to go to school. And then I would take my laptop to a local coffee shop and I would circle different coffee shops and I would write until the battery ran out on my laptop. And then by that point, go pick my kids up from school and so forth. And I really, I had to do that. I did also at the outset, I really tried to flesh out the characters and to really structure the story before I started writing it. So I spent a lot of time and the kind of preliminary work. That's not often how I work, but I did. Since coming back from that wonderful semester off where I'm now back into the regular workaday grind, I really have to find the time to write. But it's exactly that. I need to clear a good 2 hours. And I try and do it Monday through Friday if I'm lucky. Got to make that time and kind of keep that time sacred. And then again, unplugging the laptop and just writing until the battery goes is a great kind of motivator.
Yeah, I love that strategy. And I love that way of staying disciplined and saying, okay, I'm not getting out of this chair or I'm not leaving this coffee shop until the battery is dead and I've got some words on the screen. So I love that philosophy. I think that's great. So as we finish up with you today, Kevin, if anyone wants to get in contact with you to talk to you about writing, about Razor Cake Magazine, about other things that you're involved in, where can they find you? How can they get in contact with you, first of all? And then where can they get copies of Vicious Is My Middle Name?
Yeah, so there is a website that I created. It's www.kcdunn, so kcdunn.com. And there's contact information there as well as links to all the various types of writing and work that I do, whether it's academic or, you know, with music reviews or my own fictional writing. Vicious comes out in November. It's available pre-order through Fitzroy Press, which is an imprint of Regal House. It's available Amazon.com, all the regular places. Hopefully be at your local bookstore, but, you know, you can put that request in. But yeah, it's out there. It will be out there in the world. I know it's up for pre-order at Barnes and Noble and places like that as well.
Our guest today on Now Appalachia has been author Kevin Dunn. He is a writer for Razor Cake Magazine. He also is a professor at Hobart and Williams Smith Colleges, and he's the author of the brand new book. It's called Vicious Is My Middle Name. It is a book with smooth prose, outstanding dialogue, really realistic characters. And even though, as we've talked about, it's targeted for that 9 to 12-year-old age range, if you've got a reader like that in your life, I think you will find as an adult, if you pick it up and take a read, you're going to really enjoy it. And it may be that kind of book that you're going to enjoy, but also that maybe you want to sit down and read with your son or your daughter or your niece or nephew or grandson or granddaughter, because there are so many themes there to apply to both younger adults and also older adults. So, Kevin, it's a terrific book. Again, it's got one of the best titles I can think of any book that I've read or heard about. In Vicious Is My Middle Name. It's really, really a great story, and I appreciate you coming on the program. Congratulations. Thanks for the conversation, and as you get book 2 and 3 in the series done, we'd love to have you back on to talk about it. So thanks so much.
All right. Well, thank you, Elliot. It's been a pleasure.
We want to take a moment as we finish up this episode of Now Appalachia to give a special shout out to our executive producer of the program, as well as all of the programs you hear and podcasting that you hear on the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. Her name is Pam Stack. We could not bring these podcasts to you each and every time without her support and assistance. So Pam, thank you so very much. We also want to remind you that this is a copyrighted podcast that is owned and operated by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. That will do it for us this time on Now Appalachia, but please come again next time. And in the meantime, stay well and see you someplace soon, I hope.
You've been listening to Now Appalachia. This is a copyrighted podcast owned and operated by the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network. For questions or comments about this program, and to learn more about the host, Elliot Parker, and his books, visit his website at www.elliotparker.com. Stay tuned. More outstanding podcasts are coming your way next from the authors on the Air Global Radio Network.